Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada, Prabhupada ki. Devaki helplessly, piteously appealed to Kamsa. My dear brother, all good fortune unto you. Don't kill this girl. She will be your daughter-in-law. Indeed, it is unworthy of you to kill a woman. Purport. Kamsa had previously excused Devaki because he thought that a woman should not be killed, especially when pregnant. But now, by the influence of Maya, he was prepared to kill a woman, not only a woman, but a small, helpless newborn child. Devaki wanted to save her brother from this terrible, sinful act. Therefore, she told him, don't be so atrocious as to kill a female child. Let there be all good fortune to you, for you. Demons can do anything for their personal benefit, not considering what is pious or vicious. But Devaki, on the contrary, although safe because she had already given birth to her own son, Krishna, was anxious to save her daughter of someone else. This was natural for her. Was anxious to save the daughter of someone else. This was natural for her. Om Agyana Chimirandasya Jananjana Shalagaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Chashmai Shri Kurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobistam Stabitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantakam Vancha Kalpatarubhyas Cha Kripa Sindhubhya Vacha Pajitanam Pavane Pyuvahisunamipyo Namonuha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadara Shri Vasari Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Okay, so here we see the demon and the devotee interacting with each other. The mood is slightly different from Kamsa to Devaki. We see Kamsa, he is basically defending himself because material consciousness means anxiety. As soon as you accept the material body or the material consciousness as such, there is anxiety for loss of identity, right? If you identify the body as the self, the body is perishable, identity will be lost, so fear is there. In the same way, just if you identify as the controller and enjoyer, regularly you're reminded this is not the case. So there is a loss of identity, fear arises from this. And as such, we can see that principles are kind of subject to change. He's excusing Devaki because, no, we're not killing women. But then suddenly here is the child, and he's been told that this child is going to be the end of him. And even though it's a girl child and something's off, still the idea comes up, you know, why don't we just, you know, alleviate ourselves of the problem? So the principles are not actually, there are actually no principles in material consciousness. Everything is subject to change because knowledge goes the wrong way. It goes from facts, from projection, from our senses to our logic, and then that supposedly establishes some kind of authority. So question is, what facts are we using? How do we decide what facts to use? Well, the intelligence itself doesn't make decisions. It just compares and contrasts. That's what it does. So if it's not the Shabda, then it can only be the mind. It can only be the senses themselves. Based on whatever we have been surrounding ourselves with, then we will come up with whatever facts we need. We see it in modern science. There are many, many studies that show that consciousness affects something, if you're measuring it, or like quantum electrodynamics and stuff like that, that there is actually consciousness, seeming consciousness behind Brahman or behind reality. Now, for us, that's not a big deal. That's normal. But for the modern scientist who thinks he can control everything in his laboratory, these facts are not used when they are making their thesis. They're just put on the sideline. So the whole concept of being objective is an illusion. Now, being objective is the argument they use for why they are an authority. Because otherwise it would just be because I say so. That's not a very strong position. So their argument is, no, we're objective. But the whole concept of objective is illusion. so they don't have any authority. And in the same way we see here Kamsa, he's constantly anxious, even though he's so powerful, because deep down he knows there is also super soul going on inside Kamsa. He's none different in that sense. So all this anxiety is here, and as such, in this situation, the principles are therefore subject to change according to what time, place, and circumstances he finds himself in. He will use either these facts or those facts just to make things easier for himself. Now, this is not something we are very impressed by, obviously. Here, we see at the same time Devaki. I mean, you could easily say she's... I mean, we would have to give her... She's tolerant, right? She's being treated quite badly. And at the same time here, Devaki wanted to save her brother from this terrible sinful act. She's still looking upon him mercifully. It's not that she... I mean, okay, she wants to save the child, Yogamaya, of course, but there's still compassion for Kamsa. So this is a quite an elevated state of Krishna consciousness. I mean, we are dealing with the 10th canto here, so we're not dealing with neophytes here, right? So we have, like, we can see, and this is the beginning of 10th canto, right? So Kamsa, he's kind of the bottom of the pile, just selfish, looking at reality from whatever gives him a personal benefit, and from that he claims dharma or principles or, you know. So this is demonic. This is just straight up demonic. I mean, that's what you get when you're the son of Hiranyakashipu, I guess. You know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So then we have like the neophyte devotee, like the demigod. When something goes wrong, Kamsa, Hiranyakashipu, all their friends, they devise new plans. They change reality. They bend the truth. They lie if they have to, whatever, just to make it look good on the surface. Now the demigods, they approach Krishna. That's basically the difference. I mean, if you're a devotee or demon, the difference is when something goes wrong, do you think of God or do you think of it's the world's fault? You know, basically, I can't be wrong because I'm perfect, so it must be the world that's wrong, right? So that's the difference. Now the demigods, they are neophyte devotees. Because they're very, very pious, and therefore they have these very exalted positions, materially speaking. But in terms of Krishna consciousness, they're still neophytes, because what are their prayers surrounded? I mean, what's the center of their prayers is themselves. It's when they're in trouble, they approach Krishna and say, could you help me out here? It's not really working out the way I want it to. So like the Vitrasura comes and Indra, he's praying, I don't know what to do about this guy. Could you help me out here? More advanced, we would have to say, is Devaki, because she's not praying for herself. She's not fearful for herself. She's got Krishna as a son. She's doing pretty well. So she's praying for others, even the demons she's praying for, right? And then there's the whole switching of the children. What's that about? What's the difference between Devaki and Mother Yashoda? Now we're getting into some subtleties. This is why, you know, Prabhupada said 10th canto, maybe just start with canto 1 and work your way up. Because they both want Krishna as their son, but where Devaki is more on the side of wanting God as her son, Mother Yashoda is on the side of just wanting Krishna as her son. God, not God, that's irrelevant. Does that make sense? It's a very subtle point. But if you have the mood of wanting to serve God as a mother, God will reciprocate. You get God as a son. And then he's removed, because the relationship is removed. Does that make sense? And when you have awe and reverence, the relationship is restricted by that awe and reverence. We know the example of the high court judge. When you meet him in the courtroom, you don't go up and slap him a high five and say, how's it going? How's the kids? It's restricted because he's the authority. He's, well, not God, although close, but he's the authority, and therefore the relationship is restricted. Now, Mother Yashoda doesn't care, God, no God, whatever. She just likes Krishna. She loves Krishna. She wants to give her life to Krishna. And that motherly love means that Krishna positions himself as her son in the relationship. Not formally. It's not like that's not the case and that's not the issue whether or not it's on his birth certificate says son of Mother Yashoda. That's not, who cares? It's the relationship itself. It's the interaction itself. So here is more formal. So then you get that switch, you know, where Yogamaya is coming to Devaki and can connect her. So that's basically the different kind of moods we have. Demonic or devotee, neophyte devotee, where you're approaching God. We can call it kind of Paramatma realization. God is involved, but he's kind of an order carrier. It's not about God as such, but he's involved, and we know that he's the one actually doing it. Then there's the Bhagavan realization, where no, it's all about God. Actually, everything is expanding from Krishna, and therefore it is all about Krishna. I'm just a dinky little dot in the whole context, so I should try and serve. But even then we have a distinction between serving formally, where you are somewhat dependent on the externals, a certain way that things work out, or in pure sweetness, where it's just about the relationship. And the fun thing happens here, that actually formalities not only go out the window, but they're kind of reversed. A lot of the taste from these very intimate dealings are when they're misbehaving, when Krishna and Balaram are stealing butter, or when Krishna goes dancing with other men's wives, or things that we would externally look at and say, this is impious. This is, if we look at the Dharma Shastra, we are not following here, you know. But because it's so personal, see, what is pious? Pious is what Krishna likes. So if Krishna wants to break the rules, that's pious. That's what in Vaikuntha is a little bit of an issue. It's described in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, when we're in Vaikuntha, that they're dependent on the externals, on the formal way of Pancharatrika, the forms of worship, right? So when someone what's his name, Gopal. Gopa Kumar, when he comes and he's just so spontaneous and he just loves Krishna, and it kind of breaks the mood, and they have to kind of tell him, I don't think you belong here. You know, we get what you're doing. It's great. But could you maybe do it somewhere else? Because you're kind of messing up our mood here. Right? So they're dependent on the externals. So it's not, that's what it's pure devotional service, but it's not pure unalloyed devotional service. Pure unalloyed devotional service is that it's even rasa when Krishna disappears, and we thought he was going to stay here, but then he's gone, and what the hell is happening? That even generates, that's even actually the highest rasa, this rasa in separation. Now, we have quite a bit of ways to go before we get there. So we should probably just start by looking at, are we actually a demon or a devotee? You know, that's the Bhagavad Gita approach. There are two types of people. There are demons and devotees. And when we say demons, we don't mean like horns and these things. It's not like that. It's just a mentality. Asura, you know, a non-sura. It's not, they call themselves demons, you know, like Prahlad is praising his father, best of the asuras. And he's like, yeah, I'm the best of them, you know. Nobody next to, nobody above. So it's not. It doesn't have anything to do with stinky, smelly, and nasty. It's just a mentality that I'm doing this for me, just looking out for number one, right? Basically, your modern mentality. I mean, it is, right? You're worth it. You can do it. You know, that's technically what we mean. It's not necessarily vicious or violent or very destructive. It's just that when it really comes down to it, we're looking out for number one, right? And then the devotee, where we may get disturbed at some times and lash out and have a situation where we don't deal properly or whatever, but ultimately we understand that it's not about me, You know, in the ideal world, I would be able to act ideally for the benefit of others at all times. Whether or not you can do that constantly, that's a matter of time. That's actually not the main thing. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says that a pure devotee is actually just someone who has understood that Krishna is the goal of everything. So then you still have some conditioning that you need to work through. But if that understanding and that desire is sincere, Krishna's not going to get in the way of that. He will arrange so that we will become purified, right? So the demon is on karma. You get what you deserve, you know. It's just mechanical. Whatever you do, you get the result. And the more self-absorbed you are, the more anxious you're going to be. That's just how it is. You see, people who are very absorbed in their exterior, their looks, they're very anxious about their looks. You know, they can't leave the house without spending an hour in front of the mirror. Whereas people like me, not so much. You know? So it's just, that's just not, okay, I have plenty of other problems, trust me, but that's just not one of them. So the devotees, they are functioning on Krishna karma, not just mechanical karma, you get what you deserve, but actually Krishna, if you get personally involved with Krishna, he gets personally involved with you. As we surrender, he rewards us accordingly, he says in Bhagavad Gita. So when we give ourselves to Krishna, he also gives himself. So then he's personally involved, and the things will be arranged in a personal way. Not always nice from a material perspective. That's something that happens regularly in Mayapur, where I am quite a lot, that devotees come up and talk to me about, I thought this was the spiritual world. So why is there plastic everywhere? Why is everybody noisy? Why is everyone trying to cheat me? And the rickshaw wallet drives, you know, the wrong route and all these things. Because it's not the heavenly planets. It's the spiritual world. So the spiritual world functions, or we should say the material world functions after the same principles as the spiritual world. So we shouldn't think that externally everything will be nice. What's happening is that internally, whatever is happening is purifying us so we will be able to see Krishna in everything, right? Like Devaki here, she wants to save her brother from these terrible sinful acts that he's performing, his own activities, because she's seeing Krishna in everything. So that connection, she sees that, okay, whatever you're doing here, it's not going to work. You're going to get into some trouble here. So that ability is what we achieve when we are giving ourselves personally to Krishna, right? There's plenty of suffering, as in a sense. Well, there are plenty of obstacles, let's use that word, in the spiritual world. Constantly obstacles. But there's no suffering, because it's all connected to Krishna. When Krishna leaves, we're thinking about Krishna. You know, it's a good reason to think intensely about Krishna when he's gone. It's actually stronger. We see it also with young lovers, you know, they're even more in love when they're not together. So it actually, everything just increases the taste and the absorption in Krishna. In the Vaikuntha realm, it's formalized because it just gets too wild otherwise. Now in the realm of the heavenly planets, the demigods world, it's a little bit hit and miss. Most of the time it's going well, but then suddenly Govardhan Puja gets changed and then you fry out completely, you know, and you know, so then we have Govardhan Leela. And then afterwards it's like, oh yeah, sorry guys, yeah, it's me, you know. And then you have the demon world where it's just not connected to Krishna. It's just me and this is my expansion. I'm in the middle of everything, you know, and everything is related to me and my body even. So these are kind of the four different positions that we can have. So the way to kind of measure where are we? Basically, if we have to measure, we're at one of the lowest two. Let's say it like that. If you're on the top two, you don't measure. Does that make sense? If you're thinking to yourself, am I a pure devotee? Then you're not a pure devotee, right? A pure devotee is not absorbed in whether or not he's a pure devotee. He's absorbed in Krishna. So we have to figure out, am I a demon or am I a demigod? And the problem is, we are a little bit of both. This is Kali Yuga, and there is no shortage of qualities on either side of the spectrum. So what we have to figure out is in which direction am I moving, right? So the way to move forward is to transform that which is not instinctively connected to Krishna into something that is. Does that make sense? That's what sadhana means. You take something that, like we were doing the offering before, a lamp or some water, it's just water. Okay, so then you offer it. Then there's a connection is made between you, the water, and the divine, in a sense, like Prabhupada representing the divine, right? So for Kamsa, when something like this happens, he's not thinking, where is the connection to Krishna? Why is this happening? It would seem like someone is doing something. He doesn't make that connection. He just sees, what am I going to do to get out of this? Devaki, on the other hand, she sees that connection immediately because she's on the higher. So we're flickering there. So one thing is to do is that whenever something happens that kind of takes us away from Krishna or we find it difficult, we have to actually sit down and make that connection. That's what, when we're describing the universal form of Krishna, we're describing, it's called an imaginary form of Krishna. It's not actually the form. It's the form of Krishna seen through our conditioning. So it's what we see when we see the world, but we understand that that world is Krishna. Does that make sense? That this is, I'm looking as a neophyte devotee at the universal form here. It's not Bhagavan Sri Krishna. It's not like a boy with a flute I'm seeing. I'm seeing a temple room. There's a floor, curtain, you know, all of you guys are nice. You guys are also nice. And we're having a class. Great. But these are not necessarily connected to Krishna. So I have to do that myself. So the strength of the floor holding us up so we don't fall through, that's Krishna. There was a Western philosopher, David Hume, who had this serious doubt every morning he got out of bed whether or not the floor will hold. Because, I mean, based on his sense perception, all he can say is that so far it's been working out. But technically he can't say, so he was very anxious. You know, these Western philosophers, they're going the wrong way from the projection up, and that just causes anxiety. Another one, I forget who it was, but he was checking whether or not if he was on his way to work or home from work, he would have to look in his lunchbox. If there was lunch, okay, he was on his way to work. If there was no lunch, okay, I'm going home now. Immanuel Kant, he would come home and put his umbrella to bed and then go over in the corner and stand. And then only after like 20 minutes figure out, wait a minute, I'm going to bed and the umbrella is standing over here. That's how it is. So it doesn't really work very well. The more you get absorbed in this way of thinking, the more crazy you get. So a good idea, it's recommended that we make that connection back to Krishna. When we see whatever it is we're experiencing, try and make that connection, because that will actually save us from losing our mind. Because the problem with these guys is they're so absorbed in trying to find meaning in just their sense perception that it just twists around. The false ego gets bent out of shape, right? So all the qualities, we know that. All cause of all causes, that means also the cause of all qualities. So the strength of the floor, that softness of the curtain, you know, the taste in water. You know, we have the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita where we're kind of, I remember in the beginning I thought it was a boring chapter. Okay, you got some mountains, you got some gambling, you got some, so what? But actually it's a very important chapter because it kind of hypnotizes us into thinking in that way. Actually, he's the quality in everything. But when we're talking about the Himalayas, we're talking, that's some serious quality. Or we're talking about Mount Meru, or we're talking about these primary qualities where we look at something, okay, that's a quality, right? Then it's easier to remember Krishna. And as we practice that, it becomes like a habit. So whatever you see, just remind yourself of Krishna. Because then that connection is made. From a logical standpoint, that may seem a little superfluous. You know, I mean, come on. We know it. You know, we know he's all the quality. Why do we need to kind of remind ourselves? But the problem is that there is no realization of Krishna from the logical platform, because the logical platform is a part of our material consciousness. It's a part of our material faculty, and that cannot. It's only by the mercy of Krishna. So every time we do remind ourselves that, oh, this is Krishna, he reciprocates. Yes, and that's you, right? So that actually brings us closer to self-realization. Mental speculation doesn't. It just doesn't. If we get something from authority, we can contemplate it and apply it. So there it has a function. But as a driving force on its own, it just leads us in different directions. You know, you can keep speculating. And often when I'm discussing with scholars, they don't really want to arrive at a conclusion, because then the fun stops. So they like to keep adding details, you know, but what about this? But what about this? But we already, let's deal with that later. Let's deal with this now. No, but then on the other hand, and you can keep going. And then usually when I catch them on a point where they're kind of changing the subject, the one thing they very often say, I find it kind of funny, is, yes, the discussion itself is fascinating. No, it's not. The discussion is only a tool so we can get to a conclusion, so we can become self-realized. That's the problem. If you think the discussion itself becomes a goal, that's a problem. If you think sense gratification becomes a goal, that's a problem. If you think piety itself becomes a goal, that's a problem. Whatever you think is a goal that's not Krishna is a problem. It's a tool to achieve Krishna consciousness. Right? That's the thing. We have to always kind of... Jai Shri Radha Gokula Nanda ki, Jai Shri Sita Ram Lakshman Hanuman ki, Gornitai ki. We have to analyze what it is we're doing. It's really important that we know how we think. So there's Sambandha Abhideya Prayojana. There's Sambandha means relationship, Abhideya means activity, and Prayojana means goal. So whatever it is we're dealing with, is if it's part of our Sambandha or Abhideya, that's fine. Then whatever can work. But if it becomes the Prayojana, if it becomes the goal in itself, that's a problem, because there is only one Prayojana, that's Krishna. There is only one goal. That's Krishna's desire. So, okay, technically it's Radharani, because his desire is Radharani. But we go through Krishna. Technically we're serving Radharani, who's serving Krishna, but we're approaching Krishna. So whenever we have these intermediate goals, we have to understand that they, as soon as we get to it, it has to move back to Sambandha. Does that make sense? That if I need to do some service, in order to do that service, I need to take a bath, right? Because I have to be clean so I can approach the deities or whatever. The bath mustn't be a goal. I'm standing in the bath for half an hour and I'm like, this is nice, you know. Then suddenly it's sense gratification. It has to be a tool in serving Krishna. Then everything, I don't have to actually give anything up. And anything can be used in Krishna's service. Grihastha ashram is a bona fide ashram. It's not a problem as long as we connect it to Krishna. It's completely bona fide. So the only renunciation there is the renunciation of the idea that this is mine or this is for me. I mean, there's something for Krishna, the temple, and then there is my laptop, and there's, you know, I don't have so many possessions, but you know what I mean, you know, my couch, whatever it is. No, it's all Krishna's. We're just taking care of it. And that's great, because we don't have to worry about it so much. There will always be facility for whatever we need to progress in Krishna consciousness, right? There's never a situation where you can't chant Hare Krishna, or where you can't do some service. Problem is, because we are neophyte, often we see that when some kind of trauma happens, we become unable to move past it. That some trauma happened in the past and therefore I can't surrender. That has absolutely no logical or devotional basis. That you keep coming up with this, something happened 20 years ago and that's why I'm angry and this. What you're doing is you're putting karma higher than bhakti. That the karma I'm in prevents me from being a devotee. That's absolutely untrue. And it just means that you create animosity towards the world, because that situation is unfair, and therefore it doesn't matter how I act, how I deal, I'm the victim, I can do whatever I want, right? So this is very, very dangerous, because this means, this is Vaishnava Aparad, that no, I'm the victim, therefore I can also be the perpetrator. Does that make sense? People who have trauma in their life, that always generates a very strong impression on the mind. There's no way around that. It just does. That's what samskara means. But what are you going to do with that impression? That is up to you. Some people, they make sure that nobody will ever experience what I experienced. Others become self-absorbed. I experienced this 20 years ago, therefore everyone else has to suffer the consequences. I am in my good right because nobody was looking after me back then, and therefore now I can act exactly like I want. Now the first part may be true. Nobody was maybe looking out for you back then, but the second part is completely detached from it. There's a schism there, that now you can act exactly like you want. I mean, you can, but then the consequences are there, just like with Kamsa here. Does that make sense? That we have to be very careful what we do with our trauma. There is always something in the past. I know there is for me. But we must transform it so it becomes something that generates bhakti rather than generates more karma. Because you can just get stuck in karma. Generate more and more and more and more. And it becomes more and more heavy. And finally, you collapse under it. And it becomes everyone else's fault. And it becomes all about you, and this is what a demon is. It's not someone, I mean, jivas or souls are not created good or evil. I mean, they're created good, they're made out of love. But the conditioning can become so heavy that it just gets turned around. That's why we say in the mode of ignorance, it's upside down. There's the example from Gita is given of the banyan tree, where you can't see what's up and down, the roots and the branches, what's what here. So this is why it's very, very, very dangerous. And the kind of acid test is appreciation of devotees. Are you generally appreciating devotees, or are you generally on the case, or are they generally a nuisance? You know, what do you spend your time with? That's why we say guru, sadhu, shastra. That sadhu part is how are your relationships with the devotees? Are you spending excessive amounts of time criticizing certain devotees, or being on the case of devotees, or explaining why devotees are doing stuff wrong? You know. Then you have a problem in this particular area. You may be completely elevated in other areas, but this particular area is what is holding you back, right? So, and it can be very, very tricky, because maybe you're right. Maybe these devotees are nonsense. We are all neophytes. But the question is, one, do you have the relationship to actually do something constructive about it? And two, do you have the position? Because the very first instruction in Bhagavad Gita, and Jiva Goswami says, when something is mentioned first, it's because it's important. If it's mentioned last, it's because it's important. If it's repeated, that's because it's important. Now, this instruction is in the third chapter of Gita and the 18th chapter of Gita. So it's both repeated, and it's first, and it's last. So we would have to say that's probably something we should make a note of. And the instruction is, you do your duty, not someone else's duty. That's the point. So are we acting like that, or are we generally very busy looking at who else is not doing their duty correctly, even though it has nothing to do with our duty? I would say this is probably the single biggest problem in our movement right now, that we're looking at others and finding faults. And we may be right, it may be true, whatever we're saying, but it's not our job. Does that make sense? It's not that nobody's looking out for this area. It's that too many people who are not actually involved in it are. Right? So this is very dangerous. This is what is going to make that... Are you on what? Which side are you on? On the demonic side or the devotee side? It's going to either drag you in one direction or liberate you in the other direction. Right? So we also see in Upadeshamrita, first verse, first lines... Vacho vigam manasakrodha vigam. Beware of speaking and beware of the anger of the mind. This is the very first instruction in the etiquette of Vaishnava behavior, right? Don't go around talking about too many things, you know. If you have something constructive, say it. But we should be careful about these things. because it just generates, you know, it generates too much emotion, and people feel like compelled to give their opinion also. And we say it's important to have the discussion, but it's not a discussion. There's a very clear definition in the Vedas about what constitutes a discussion. A discussion is a situation where all parties are interested in achieving the absolute truth. That's a discussion. The other is called jalpa, from prajalpa. It's just useless talk. You're just pushing a point. You have an opinion, and you're pushing it. And if someone else can convince you, then okay, but preferably you would like to convince others. And then, of course, that leads down to Kamsa's stage here, vitanda, where you're just attacking anyone who's not acting in the way that you would prefer they act. That's the mode of ignorance, right? So this is very—it's very delicate. It happens very, you know, it's very subtle, you know. So we have to be very careful about these things, because everything is relationships. So if we have nice relationships with the devotees, our success is guaranteed. If we don't, the opposite is probably pretty much guaranteed, right? We see Kamsa here. He gets liberated, but it's not the preferred method of getting liberated. And he doesn't go to Goloka Vrindavan, you know, so it's not recommended. We don't advise taking this path. We would prefer if you go the other way. And it's also much more pleasurable, right? So that's a little bit about demons and devotees. We have a few minutes. Is there any questions on this or...